Okay, we're going to start here 9 lines from the bottom of Kof Aleph Amud Bet. Where it says, Amar Mar Zutra, V'itemar Mar Ukva, T'chila Nitna Torah L'Yisrael B'chtav Ivri, Lashon HaKodesh. The original Torah was given in the writing, meaning the script that was given in was the script Ivri, Lashon HaKodesh. And the language, obviously, was Hebrew. Chazra V'nitna Lahem B'mei Ezra, in the time of Ezra, it was given again, B'chtav Ashurit, Lashon Aramit. So the script changed from Ivri to Ashurit, and then the language was Aramit, was Aramaic or Aramean. Birluhem Israel, even though there were two separate givings of the Torah, the Jews cherry-picked from that and said they wanted Ktav Ashurit, Lashon HaKodesh, which is what we have today. It's just the Ktav Ashurit, or the block type of lettering, Lashon HaKodesh in Hebrew. Ve'nichud hejotot, and they left for the lay people, Ktav Ivrit, Lashon Arami. So the writing of Ivrit and the language of Arami was left. Man hejotot, who are these hejotot, who are these lay people that they left it to? Rav Chista Kutai, they left it for the Kutin. Or the Shomronim, as we know them. My Ktav Ivrit. What exactly is this Ktav Ivrit that they're speaking about? Amar Rav Chista, Ktav Libona. So Rashi says the Ktav Libona is Otiot Gdolot, large letters. Kein Otaj Kodvim Mikmeot Mezuzot, like the ones that they write on the amulets and the Mezuzot. Tosafot, on the other hand, says he brings two interpretations. He brings the first interpretation is Ktav Libona. Yesh Mifashim Kazeh Ot Nasit Min Alavan, that you create a border around it, and the letter is from the white that is not inked out. But the Balei Tosafot reject that, because that's something called Chak Tochut, which we spoke about in Minachot. It's a problematic type of Ktav. And therefore, at the end, you can see here, the Rabbeinu Tam Perish, the Shein Makom, Rishma Libon'a, Gotmiro Ktav Mishune, the name of a place. And they write this strange type of script, and that's the script that we're referring to here as Ktav Ivri. So whether this means that the Ktav Ivri was this more cursive type of writing, and the Ashurit was more blocked, or maybe even the other way around. Libuna might have been seems like larger letters, and more separated or distinct or delineated letters, versus the Ashurit, which is a more flowing type of script. It may not be similar to the script that we have today in the Sefer Torah, but rather if you go to you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Israel Museum and the Shrine of the Book, you can see there the type of script that they were referring to, which was a very cursive type of Hebrew that they wrote at that time, and that was used to write all the books around the time of Beit Sheni, and that might be what they're referencing to over here. So Tanya Rav Yossi Omer, Ra'uya Ezra Shinatein Torah Yadol Yisrael. Ezra was of such a stature that the Torah could have been given through him to Israel. Ilmalei Kademo Moshe. Had Moshe not preceded him, then Ezra would have been the man to do it. But Moshe already did it, so we didn't need Ezra to do it. Moshe Omer Moshe Ala Lelukim, because it says by Moshe that Moshe went up to God. Bezra Omer, Hu Ezra Ala Mi Bavel. That he's Ezra who went up from Bavel. So Ma Aliyah Hamur Kan Torah, Af Aliyah Hamur Lahalan Torah. Just like the Aliyah by Moshe Rabbeinu references to the Torah, so to the Aliyah of Ezra references to the Torah. But Moshe Hu Omer, this week's parsha that we just read, that at that time Hashem commanded me to teach you the chukim and the mishpatim. Ezra Omer ki hechin Ezra lebavo lidrosh et Torat Hashem v'lasot ulamed b'Yisrael chukim mishpat. So they're connecting between the chukim mishpat by Ezra to the chukim mishpat that's found here in Parshat Etchanan, and we're saying is that there is a similarity between Moshe Rabbeinu and Ezra. Now, it's true that if had you just put the Aliyah together, it would be a very precarious connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and Ezra, which you guys noted that the Psukim here, it's a big stretch to say the Aliyah that is by Ezra, which is speaking about him going from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, is similar to the Aliyah that Moshe has when he goes up the mountain to God. On the other hand, we find in the personality of Ezra, as well as the things that he did in Sefer Ezra, that he reminds us as of a leader like Moshe Rabbeinu. He interprets the Torah, he reads the Torah, he brings the people together, he does all of these public type of events, including the celebration of the holidays, and the reinstitution of many halachot, as well as, we saw before, the issue of dealing with the intermarriage. Ezra is a significant leader, and the psukim call him a sofer, similar to what we call Moshe Rabbeinu a sofer. So there are a lot of other parallels between Ezra and Moshe that would lead you to have that connection. And the Gemara here is noting the Gzeir Shava. I don't think Aliyah is the main part of that Gzeir Shava. The Chukim and Mishpatim or Chok Mishpat are much stronger, I think, connection, as well as the other thematic things that Ezra does in his lifetime that make him similar to a leader like Moshe Rabbeinu, as well as the fact that he's leading the people from Bavel back to Eretz Yisrael, just like Moshe Rabbeinu was leading the people from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael. Even though it didn't happen that way, that the Torah was given by Ezra, but nevertheless, he was a contributing factor to the change in the script that was used. Shinemar, because the pasuk says in Ezra, Viktav Hanishtavan Katuv Aramit Umuturgam Aramit. And so the letter that was written contained within it the script of Aramit, and it was in the language of Aramit. Uchtiv, and then in Daniel it says, Velo ka'alein iktava l'mikre upishre. The writing that was found there, they could not read or interpret, the Oda l'malka, to tell the king what was meant by it. So now, the pasuk in Daniel is the writing that is found on the wall by Belshazzar. And Belshazzar, from his dream and from the interpretation of what he wants, he calls all the chachamim in to try to tell him what's going to happen. And nobody can read it, and nobody can interpret it. That's what the Gemara is playing on over here. How was it that nobody could read or interpret it if it was something that the Jews knew about, or the Jews had a lot of information about? Why is it that Daniel was the only one who knew how to read it, knew how to interpret it? So the suggestion of the Gemara is that Ezra was instrumental in introducing a change in the language, as well as the Ktav. And so Daniel was the one who was familiar with it, while others, and the many Jews that were found there, were not familiar with it because the change had yet to happen, or had just happened. It was something new, and therefore they hadn't been exposed to this yet. And so therefore, even though the letters of Ezra speak about this Ktav Aramit, Umturgam Aramit, they're still not able to read that which is written on the wall by Belshazzar. Uchtiv, and the Pasuk says, V'ktav et Mishneh Torah Zot, that you have to write down this Mishneh Torah. Now, Mishneh usually means to review or to go over, but over here, the Gemara is reading it, Mishneh Torah Zot, Ktav Aroy Lishtanot. This is a script that is worthy of being changed or can be changed, implying that it was already embedded in the Torah, the fact that the script could change or would be changed in the future. Now, that's important because we know that a Navi is not allowed to be Mechadesh. He's not allowed to bring anything new. He's not allowed to change anything from the Torah. But if you believe that it's already embedded in the Torah in that way, then maybe it's not a problem for the Navi to come along and interpret or change it because the Torah already recognized that possibility or that opportunity. So now, Lamani Kras Shurit. So then why is the script that we're speaking about here called Ashurit? Shalai Mehem Me'ashur. Because it came up with them from Ashur. It's also very difficult because Ashur, Assyria, were the ones who put the Aseret HaShvatim into Galut, but we don't find the Aseret HaShvatim coming back necessarily. Elohim Kain, you think that that's the case by Yirmiyahu. But nevertheless, saying that it came from Ashur seems very strange. So what you have to say here is that the Ashur is not really Ashur, it means Bavel. It's something that they brought up with them from Bavel. Tanya Rabbi Omer, B'tchila B'ktav Zeh Nitna Torah L'Yisrael, that this was the original script that B'nai Yisrael had. Kevin Shat Chatu, after they sinned, Nepach Lehen L'Ro'etz. Then it changed to them, or became to them like a broken or ruined type of script. Kevin Shechazru Behen Echziru Lehem. Once they did Tshuva, Hashem brought back the original script. So that's what it means here, that they went through stages of the script where the original script was Ashurit. Then something happened where B'nai Yisrael degraded and sinned, and therefore the Ktav also degraded. Like we said before, that was a Ktav Libona'a. It was this less than desirable type of Ktav. And B'nai Yisrael had that for a period of time, and then it was reinstated or restored to the old ways of Ashurit. Shemar, because the pasuk says, you should return those that are in the fortresses, those that are incarcerated and have hope. Gamayom, even today, Magid Mishneh Ashivlach. Hashem says, I will speak to you, or I will declare the Mishneh and return it to you. The Gemara is interpreting the Mishneh Ashivlach means that the original writing, I will return to you, or return you to the original state of the script. So then, Lamani Krashma Ashrit, if that's the case, why is it called Ashrit? Shemi Usheret Bichtav. Because it was the most appropriate or the best type of script. I mean, it was a wonderful or excellent script. Shimon ben Elazar Amir Mishum Rabbi Eliezer ben Parto, Shamar Mishum Rabbi Elazar Amodai, Ktav Zelo Nishtana Kol Ikar. The writing, the script, never changed. Shnemar Vavei Amudim. It says by the Mishkan that the Amudim had Vavim on them. Vavim, till today in the modern Hebrew as well, a Vav is a hook, but it's also the name of the letter Vav. The reason that a hook is called a vav is because it looks like a vav. And so therefore there's a correlation between the vavim, which are an item that are shaped a certain way, and the letter. But what it shows us is that the vav of the time of the Mishkan is no different than the vav we have today, which is that it looks like a hook. Ma'amudim lo nishtanu, just like the amudim of the Mishkan never changed, afavim lo nishtanu, so too the vav that was there also didn't change. Vomer, and it says in Esther, Veliyudim chichtavam echulshonam. They sent out the letters to the Jews in their script and in their languages. Malishonam lo nishtana, just like their language never changed, achtavam lo nishtana, so too, their script never changed. Elamani mikayem et mishneh Torah zot, that according to this opinion where the script never changed, then what do you do with the pasuk of Mishneh Torah Zot? Mishneh Torot. Teach you that you need two Torot. Echad sheyotza v'nichneset imo. One that goes in and out with the king. Echad shemenechet lo bebeit gnazav. And one that he keeps in his treasury in his storehouse. Ota sheyotza v'nichneset imo. The one that goes in and out with him. Oseh oto kemin kemeya. V'toleh bizroo. He makes it into a amulet. V'toleh bizroo. And he ties it onto his arm. That might remind you of tefillin, right? Something very similar to tefillin. And that might be what's being indicated over here. And I'll explain that a little bit in a second. Shenemar, Shiviti Hashem lenegdi tamid. That I place Hashem opposite me constantly. So that's the idea of putting it on the arm so that it's always there, always present for the person. Ve'idach, those that believe that the Ktav did change. So then what do they do with this Shiviti Hashem lenegdi tamid? Hai Shiviti my Dorishpe. And we by the way, Kidrav Chana Bar Bisna. They need for that limud, which is Damar Rechana Bebizna Rabbi Shimon Chasida, Mitpalel, Tzarech Shiret Smok Ilu Shechina Kenegdo. President Davins, he has to have the sense, the feeling, the awareness that he is davening opposite the Shechina. Shnemar, Shavit Hashem, the Negdi Tamit, that when you're davening to Hashem, he's literally in front of you, he's literally there, listening to you as if you're speaking to a king on the throne. Alright, so if you look in the Rabbeinu Chanano, Rabbeinu Chananel, a couple lines down, towards where the Gemara lines get wide, he says over there, Ve'en halacha kemar ukva, the halacha is not like mar ukva, da'akai ma kitanae, because we hold like these tanaim, or this machloket tanaim, velo kirabi yosi, and not like Rabbi Yosi, elekai melon kach, this is what we believe, this is what we think the halacha is. Shkutav ze nitan le Moshe b'sinai. This ktav was originally given to Moshe at Har Sinai, kida amrinan. Like we say in the Gemara, that mem v'samach, the mem here is a mem sofit, and the samach, shebeluchot b'neis hayu omdim. They stood up miraculously. V'chein v'vei amudim. And also here, by v'vei amudim, we see this reinforcement that the script was the same script that we have today, was the script back then. V'en alocha kimoto shenishtana. The alocha is not like those that think that the language changed. This script never changed, ever. So that is the conclusion based on this. What the Rabbeinu Chananel suggests here is that the conclusion is that none of this is true. All these opinions that believe that Nishtaneh Ktav somehow it changed or something was different about it, none of those are correct. The correct view is this view here that nothing changed. From the original script and language that we had, that's what we have today as well. And so therefore, the question about the Chat'u, in order to incorporate or reconcile with what the Rabbeinu Chananel quoted over here, it would suggest that if the Samach and the Mem Sofit stood by a miracle, because we're assuming that that was a Shurit, and that's what contributed to the fact that it was miraculous that they were stuck in mid-air, because if you carved all the way through the Luchot, then the middle of the Samach, the middle of Mem Sofit, would fall apart or fall out. So that was the Nes and the miracle of the Luchot. It really derives from a belief that it was Asherit. And so therefore the chatu had to be post that period of time. So it's not clear what the chatu is, but it had to be after that time of the luchot, because the luchot have this problem that's really contributed by the use of asherit. Now, as far as the archaeological studies, you don't have to go back that far to see that our ktav has changed. Even if you go back to the Beit Yosef, the way the Beit Yosef describes the letters and writes the letters is different than the we write it today. And that is, over time, the way that we write letters changes, partly because of the style of how we write them, as well as what we use to write with. So there are people, Sfaradim, that are makpid, to write their Sifrei Torah, the Mezuzot, with a reed, and not to use a quill. That is because that was the original way that they did it, and that was, in the time of the Gemara, the way that they wrote these things. The problem is that if you use a reed instead of a feather or quill, you don't get the fineness of their ktav. And so the way that we structure our letters today requires a certain fineness of penmanship that can only be accomplished by a very sharp quill. And so that almost, in a sense, negated the ability to use the reed for the writing of a sofer. And again, that difference contributes to the strongness of the shape of our letters and how detailed as well as curved they can be, because if you have a much narrower, finer point, you have more capacity to deal with those things. And if you look in the Beit Yosef, the letters that he drew are different than the letters we have. But it's interesting, I have a friend who's a sofer, and he told me that he went to the Gdolei Hador of Kanievsky to ask about this issue. He writes in the Ktav Beit Yosef. He's one of the people who knows how to write the original Ktav Beit Yosef. Somebody called him up, and he wrote a pair of tefillin like that, and he asked them, was there a value in doing that? And they said, we have the Ktav we have today. He says, but is there something to do? L'chatchila. He said, if you want to write it, you can write it. They would not give him a definitive answer about it, but it was clear that they didn't believe that there was any benefit or added benefit to writing like the Ktav Beit Yosef, even though it's changed. So I would say that there's a certain amount of evolution in the Ktav based on the nature of the parchment, the nature of the writing utensil, and so therefore there is some sort of progression in the shape and the nature of the Ktav. So that means that the Ktav that we have today, as strong as the Masorah is, how we do it and exactly how it's done, there is definitely an acknowledgement that some of it has changed slightly or in a nuance because of the different periods of time, the difficulties, as well as the capacity to change things based on the technology, the utensils that we write with or write on. Correct. You go back to the coins that they find from Beit Rishon. That script is extremely, ancient Hebrew is extremely hard to read. Whether that was like what they had in Ethiopia, which was, that was the common man's script versus the script of the Kodesh, or whether that was the script all along, it's hard to tell. Back from then, we don't have the both scripts that we can tell. But you're right, in the Beit Sheni already, the script is different. It's much more cursive, it's much more circular in nature, but it is readable, it is discernible and readable, and it bears a strong resemblance to what we have today. Again, if you go back earlier, it's harder to say that, and that might have to do with what was said here about Ezra, that Ezra changed it. If that's the case, then it would explain it very easily, why there's a difference, because there was a ktav back then and a ktav now, and they changed the ktav. So they accepted the change in ktav, they didn't accept the change in language. So Ezra wanted to change from Hebrew, ktav Ivri, to Asherit and Aramit, and they took the Asherit, but they didn't take the Aramit, and so there was Asherit in Hebrew. And that could explain that difference in the scripts that we find from the coins left from Beit Rishon, versus coins or inscriptions that we have from Beit Rishon versus what we have from much later in Beit Sheni. Alright. According to Rabbi Shimon, it says that the writing of the script never changed. Then what do you say about that story in Daniel where they can't read the script that's on the wall? Why can't they read the script? If it didn't change, anybody who was Jewish should be able to read it. It's written in Hebrew lettering. So, Amar Rav, Bigmatria Ichtiv, Lahon. It was written in Gematria. Now, Gematria here does not mean the association with a numerical value with each of the letters. Rather, Gematria over here means a coded system. For instance, the first one we're going to see is Atbash. Atbash is a coding system by which the first letter of the alphabet is matched up with the last letter of the alphabet. So it's Aleph and Tov. And then the second letter is matched up with the second to last letter. That means Bet and Shin. Gimel will be matched up with Resh. And so on. So that's the nature of the code. It's not so complex. But then, this is what was written on the wall according to this part of the Gemara, which is, it was written on the wall, Yud Tet Tof, Aleph Yud Dalet Chof Sofit. Three words, and then the last word here is Pei, Vav, Gimel, Chet, Mem Tet. if you do the atbash for that, then you come out with the following. Minei, minei, tekelu parsin. So if you do atbash on them, you end up with this wording, which is exactly what Daniel reads to Belshazzar off of that writing in the end. That they had to do a certain amount of decoding in order to get to the key to the puzzle. And the key to the puzzle was atbash. My parish tohu. So what did he explain? Meaning that when you take those four words and you do atbash on them, what comes out? It comes out to the pasuk in Daniel. Perakei pasuk chavei. Minei minei takel uparasin. Minei mina elaka malchutach. God has counted the years of your reign. Ashlama. The word lecha is not there. So God has numbered the years, the length of your reign, and terminated it, brought it to an end. The tekel, tekilta, and he has weighed b'moznaya on the scales. V'hishtakachat chasir, and he finds you wanting. Trace, prisat malchutach, v'atamadai uparas. And he has divided or broken your kingdom, and he's now given it to the Persia Medians, which is that Belshazzar is going to die or be murdered that night. Basically, the Babylonians are going to be overrun by the Persia Median Empire, and this was a prediction on the wall that that was going to happen, that God had weighed the worthiness of Belshazzar and find him wanting, and therefore it's going to be given to his good neighbors, the Persian Median Empire, which will then have the stories of Purim, of Shushan HaBira, of the Persian Median Empire, which could be connected to the beginning of that perek, which discusses Belshazzar taking out the Kelim from the Beit HaMikdash, and that's what the Gemara in Megillah discusses. But what you see here is the interpretation of the script that was found on the wall. What they're doing in the Psukim is taking each word and then explaining or expounding on that word. They expanded on Minei, they expanded on Takel, and they expanded on Parasin. And each of those describe what's about to happen to Belshazzar. Shmuel Amar, Mimatos, Nakfei Eladan. The way that Shmuel has it is if you look through these words, you take the first letter of each of these three words, it spells Mem Nun Aleph, which is Minei. Mem Nun Aleph is the second letter of every word. And then you have Tuf, Kuf Lamed is the third letter of each word, which is the Tkel. And then if you take the remaining letters of each word, then you get the Uparasin. That would spell it out, basically, by lining it up and taking each letter from each word and matching them up. That'll spell out what was there. Yochanan Amar, Anam Anam Lakat Nisrufu. Should be able to see there that he reversed the words. They're spelled backwards. Memnon Aleph is spelled backwards. Memnon Aleph. Kof Lamed spelled backwards. And then Uparasin, which is also spelled backwards. That's where Yochanan says the coding was. Rashi Amar, Nema Nema Tekatel Pursin. So over here, he just has the first two letters exchanged. So the Mem and the Nun are exchanged. It would be Minei Minei Takao Uparasin. So it's just the first two letters are switched their places. Instead of being the first letter, it's the second letter. And vice versa, for the second letter is the first letter. And that was the decoding that they needed. So in all these cases, you have suggestions as to what was needed over there to decode the wording that was on the wall. And we have these numerous suggestions as to what that was, or what the nature of the coding was that needed a key to interpret it, as opposed to those that viewed the problem being that there was no coding, but rather the problem was that they weren't familiar with the language, and only Daniel had the exposure to the language at that point in time, or the script that was being used, because it was brand new from the time of Ezra. And now the next mishnah begins, let's continue along with the king. Ein rochvim al suso, can't ride his horse. Ve'yoshvim al kiso, he can't sit on his throne. Ve'yoshvim shim b'shavito, nobody can use his scepter. Ve'yoshvim al kishu mistaper, you can't see him when he's getting a haircut. Lo'shu arum, and not when he is undressed. Ve'lo kishu b'beit ha'merchatz, not when he's in the bathhouse. Shenemar som tisim alecha melech, shtei mato alecha. His fear should be upon you, and therefore it would be inappropriate for him to be seen in these, we'll call them quote-unquote compromised situations, because that would diminish, in some ways, the fear of the king. Amar Rav Yaakov and Rav Yochanan, Avishag Muteret L'Shloma. Avishag HaShunamit, which we'll see in a second, it's the story at the beginning of Melachim Aleph, Basrura Adoniah. On the other hand, she was restricted to Adoniah, who is Aniyah ben Chagit, is one of the sons of David, who tries to usurp the kingship right before David's death, instead of Shlomo HaMelech being the rightful heir to the throne. So now, Muteret L'Shloma, she was permitted to Shlomo, the Melech Chaya, because he was a king. Melech Mishtamesh B'Shavito Shel Melech. And the next king can use the scepter of the previous king, or he can use the possessions or the household of the previous king. And since Shlomo was a king, he had a right to Avishag HaShunamit. Basura la'adoniya, on the other hand, she was restricted to Adoniya, de'ajotu, because he was a lay person. So now, what's interesting about this is because the story there is that Adoniya petitions Batsheva to go to Shlomo to allow him to marry Avishag HaShunamit. Shlomo is wise enough to figure out what he's trying to do, which was he was trying to get Avishag HaShunamit, because if he married Avishag HaShunamit, that would be a demonstration, in a sense, of him being the crown prince. Because only the next king would be permitted to marry the previous king's, we'll call it quote-unquote wife here, because we'll see in a second she wasn't his wife, but somebody associated with the royalty of the previous king would only be appropriate for the next king. But for someone who was a lay person, it wouldn't be. So Adoniah wants Batsheva to petition Shlomo to get him Avishag HaShunamit, because he thinks that will then bolster his case that he's really the heir to the throne. Shlomo figures it out and basically says to his mother, Batsheva, what are you trying to do? You're trying to sell the kingship away from me? You're trying to give it away to Adoniah? And therefore he goes after Adoniah for violating the terms of the agreement between them. Where it says, Avishag Mahi. What's the story of Avishag? Tichtev HaMelech David Zakein Baba Yamim. David was getting older. This is the Haftorah for Parshat Chayei Sarah. Imrlo Avadav. And his servant said to him, Yivakshu LaMelech. They go out to find for the king a nice, beautiful woman. Uchtiv, v'yivakshu nara yafa. That they searched for a very beautiful woman. Uchtiv, v'nara yafa ad me'od. In case you didn't figure it out, she was very beautiful. V'tihi l'melech sochenet, v'teshartehu. And she was a nurse to the king. And she serviced him. Amra dinasban. She says, Avishag HaShunamit says to David, let us get married. Amrla asirit li. He said to her that you are restricted to me. I cannot marry you. Amrle. So she pokes fun of him a little bit and says, Chasre leganva nafshe leshloma nakit. When the ganav has no business, he has nothing to steal, he makes himself into this peace-loving type of guy. Since he has no business available to him, in terms of the business of stealing, he all of a sudden acts like this self-righteous individual who's only looking for peace and good things and good-natured things. So she says the same thing over here. The reason you don't want to marry me is not because you're not allowed to marry me, but because you don't have a desire anymore for a beautiful woman like me. Amalahu, Karuli the Batsheva. David HaMelech says to the gathered individuals there, bring Batsheva in, who's his wife. Uchteva tavo Batsheva l'melech ha-chadra. Batsheva comes to the king in his chamber. Amrav Yehuda Amarav, boto sha'a kincha Batsheva b'shloshesei mapot. That Batsheva had to clean herself 13 times, because David had intercourse with her 13 times, and they base it on the number of words in the Pasuk. That's what Rashi says, that the Pasuk over there has 13 words in it. Truth is that there are actually 14 words in the Pasuk, just that I guess they can count the word Batsheva as a single word, and therefore there are 13 words in the Pasuk. So you see that David's desire was just as strong as it was originally, but he said to her, I cannot marry you, because of the fact that David already had reached the maximum number of wives that he was permitted, which were 18 wives. Amar Rav Shimon bar Abba, Bo'urei kama kashin gerushin. See how difficult divorce is. Shrei David HaMelech hitiro lo liyichud. David HaMelech, they allowed him to violate the Isser of Yichud. V'lo hitiro lo legaresh. But they did not permit him to divorce his wife. The easy solution would be that he divorces one of his 18 wives, and then he could have taken Avishag HaShunamit as a wife. But the fact that we didn't advise him to do that, but rather we told him better to be biyuchud Avishag HaShunamit and not to divorce your other wives, shows you the gravity by which we look at divorce. Someone who divorces his first wife, afilu mizbeach morid alav dima'ot. Even the mizbeach is crying for that individual. Shneamar bezot shenit ta'asu kasot dim'a et mizbach Hashem b'chi v'anaka me'ed od pnot el amincha l'kachat ratzon miyadchem. So here we're talking about the pasuk in Malachi, and the pasuk in Malachi describes Tasheni, this terrible thing that you also do. So tasu kasot dim'a et mizbach Hashem, that you cover the altar of Hashem with tears, crying and moaning. Me'ed od pnot el amincha, because I'm no longer turning to your offerings. lekachat the ratzon mideitchem, and to accept that which you are bringing. Uchtiv, v'amartem ama. You're going to say, why? Why is God no longer accepting what we're bringing? Al ki Hashem he'id bencha uben eshet ne'urecha. Because Hashem testifies to what happened between you and the woman of your youth, asher atah bagadta ba, that you rebelled against her, v'hi chaver techa, and she is your good friend, v'eshet britecha, and the woman of your covenant of your marriage. So first of all, by the way, it's a beautiful thought just about marriage, that here it says that you dealt treacherously with, rejected the woman of your youth, meaning that you rejected your marriage that came about in your youth, your first wife, and over there he calls her, v'hi chaver techa, and she is your close friend or your best friend. It's a very nice thought in terms of marriage, that marriage is more than just simply an issue of convenience. It takes him to individuals who are very close friends or best friends. And here it says that the reason that Hashem is rejecting your offerings on the Mizbeach is because you rejected her, the way that you behaved towards the wife of your youth. And it says there that the Mizbeach is Mored Dmaot. It's as if it's crying and moaning over this issue. And that's what the Gemara said over here, that even the Mizbeach is Mored Dmaot over the divorce of one's wife of their youth. And over here, people see the connection between the Mizbeach and the wife of one's youth, either being that the Mizbeach over here, which normally is something that protects the individual, yet in the Pasuk in Malachi, it's turned to be, in a sense, a prosecutor or implicates the individuals here. So too, the person who deals improperly or treacherously with the wife of his youth, that which was a defense, that which was positive for him, will now turn negative. Or even the Mizbeach that in some senses is inured to the dam that's been sprinkled in it all the time. Nevertheless, when it comes to this issue of dealing with marriage, even the Mizbeach is Morid Dma'ot. Despite all that is done to the Mizbeach still sees this as being something that is beyond what it can handle, and therefore it is Morid Dma'ot. Or the fact that the Mizbeach is the mechanism or medium by which we draw closer to God. And similarly, a marriage between husband and wife should generate, as the Gemara in Kiddushin said, that the Shekhinah b'nehem should create or bring closer the presence of God. And therefore, a break in that marriage is the equivalent of the Mizbeach crying, meaning that the medium that brings the Shekhinah has been broken in both of these instances. And so, that is why David HaMelech, in these cases, did not divorce his wives, some of which were Eshet Nurim, others of which were his primary wives, in order to facilitate his ability to take Avishag Shunamit as a wife. Person's wife only passes away if people are demanding money from him, and he doesn't have it. Shneamar, v'im'ein lecha l'shalem, lama yikach mishkavcha mitachtecha. If you have nothing to pay with, then why should they take away? Now you could read this in one of two ways. Mishkavcha mitachtecha can mean the bed that is under you, meaning that they're going to take away your basic necessities because you have nothing to pay with. And so the creditors are going to come and clean you out. Or you can read it more particularly, mishkavcha mitachtecha is the woman that you live with, that they're going to take away your wife as collateral or as payment in lieu of the fact that you couldn't pay for your loan. I mean, that it was a common practice. We know that from the story by Elisha in Melachim Bet. The woman says that the creditors are at the door. They want to take my boys. They're going to take my children because we didn't pay back the debts. My husband passed away and he was close to you, Elisha. And what are you going to do to save me? Because they're here at the door knocking to take my kids away. So it was a common practice to take the kids or the wife of an individual who defaulted on a loan. Although here the Gemara seems to be saying that it's punishment from heaven, like a midah keneged midah, that you took someone else's possession, therefore Hashem will have to take away your most prized possession, which is your wife. Alright, anybody whose first wife passes away, it's as if the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in his time. This is the story by Yechezkel, where his wife passes away, and Hashem uses that as a mashal for the Churban HaBayit. And so over there, the death of his wife is associated with the Churban HaBayit. And that's what Hashem says to him. I'm going to take from you, machmad enecha, the desire, the apple of your eye, v'magifan, a plague. Lo tispot, v'lo tichbe. You will not eulogize, you will not cry, Below davo di matecha, and you will not weep. Uchtev. And then it says, v'deber la'am b'boker. In the morning, spoke to the people. V'tamat ishti barif. And my wife had passed away in the evening. Uchtev. And then it says, hinini mechalel et mikdashi ge'onuschem. That's what Hashem is trying to convey over here. That here I'm about to profane the sanctuary, the thing that you hang your hat on, where your strength derives from. Machmad eneichem. The apple of your eye or the desire of your eye. So you see, Hashem uses the same descriptor by the Mikdash of Machmad Enechem that he uses by the wife, which is Machmad Enecha. So there you see the parallel between the wife and the Beit HaMikdash. Therefore, if the wife passes away, it's a clear equivalent of the Churban HaBayit. And it's also a strong statement about the standing of the woman of the house, which is here that the Pasuk compares her to the Beit HaMikdash, that she is the spiritual foundation and center of the house, the place where the Shekhinah resides. V'amar Rabbi Alexandria, kol adam shemeita ishto b'yamav, olam chashech v'ado. Person whose wife passes away during his lifetime, it predeceases him, then the world is dark for him. Shneamar, or chashech b'olo, v'neiru alav yidach. So, or has been darkened for him in his tent, v'neiru, and the candle, alav yidach. The candle that's upon him has flickered out. So the word oholo, ain oholo ele ishto, which is an expression in the Gemara, that Oel, or the house, or the tent, refers to his wife. And so, Or Chashach Be'olo, that the darkness has descended because of his Ohalo, because of his wife, whose candle has flickered out. Yosi Ruchanin Amar, Psiotav Mitkatzrot. A person like that, his stride is a little shorter, the bounce in his step is a little less. Shnemar, because it says there, it's true to Ade Ono, that his powerful strides will be constrained. Rabbi Bao Omer, Atzato Nofelet, that his wisdom or his advice is not as great anymore. Shnemar, V'tashlicheu Atzato, that his schemes or advice will be thrown away. So these all are part of the series of psukim from Iyov, by which the Gemara is trying to show the nature of the loss of one's wife. Amar Rabba Barachanam Rabbi Yochanan. So here is a Gemara that is on the first daf of Sota, which we spent time on explaining over there, which is Kasher Dezivugam Kikiriat Yamsuf. Now, if you think that it's terrible, the breakup of the husband or wife of their youth, either through divorce or through death, well, the reason that it's so difficult or so terrible is because putting them together is more difficult than Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea. Shneamar, Elokim Moshiv Yechidim Baita, Motzi Asirim Bekosherot. God puts down Yechidim individuals, Baita, into the house, or brings them together in the house. Motzi Asirim Bekosherot. He takes out those that are incarcerated to prosperity. So you see that God is involved in Moshiv Yechidim Baita, that he puts together individuals into a household, meaning he puts them as Shiduchim together, and Motzi Asirim B'Kosherot, and he redeems those that are enslaved, those that are trapped position, which is the Jews in Mitzrayim, who are trapped by the Mitzrayim, by the Yamsuf. Ini, is that really true? V'amarav Yudamarav, Arbeim Yom Kodem Mitzirat Avlai, Bat Kod Yotzei Tomer, Bat Ploni De Ploni. That 40 days before the conception of the fetus, there's a heavenly voice that goes out and says, so-and-so is to so-and-so, and that the shidduch is already put together even before the conception of the individual. So how hard could that be if it's all predetermined? When it says lokasha, that's not a problem. Hab zivug rishon, hab zivug sheni. That's in the first, and that is in the second. This leads to a major machloket amongst the rishonim as to what the meaning of zivug rishon is and zivug sheni. From the context of our Gemara, it seems like we're speaking about the difference between his first marriage and his subsequent marriage, which is that the first marriage, and here you can read it either way, the Rishonim read it either way, the first marriage, which is the one that God puts his effort into, and the one that the Mizbeach even cries if it's broken up, so that is something that's Kasheh Kriyat Yamsuf. On the other hand, the alternate Shidduch, the Zivug Sheni, is the one that is declared beforehand, and it's all predetermined. It's not something that has to do with what Hashem organizes, but rather it either has to do with your schuyot, or has to do with whatever is preordained. And the other Rishonim read it just the opposite, which is the Zivug Rishon is the one that's all preordained. It's the Zivug Sheni, which is so difficult, like Kriyat Yamsuf, because now God's got to replace or figure out what to do to get together the people that now had their original Shiduchim, and now we have to find a way to get together these two individuals who are not working on this preordained basis. Now, if you look in the Balei Tosafot, he says, Arim Yom Kodem Yetzirat HaVlad. So Tosafot is trying to deal with a separate issue, which is, if everything is preordained or predetermined, then what's the point of making any effort? You're just going to land wherever you're going to land because it was already preordained. First of all, in the first 40 days, it still helps daven for the child to be a zachar nekeva. Zachar. 40 days before conception, that's the time period to daven for the gender of the child. And that's what he says now. Even that preordained, it's clear Tosafot reads that Zivug Rishon is referring to the preordained, says even that could be overturned by tefillah. Tosafot is plagued by a problem, which is there's a halachic dispensation to get halachically engaged to a woman, even on Chol HaMoed, because Shemi Kadmenu Acher. Because there's afraid that someone else might jump the gun. What do you mean someone else might jump the gun? If this is a preordained marriage, who's going to jump the gun? How can anybody take away the woman that was designated for you? So that's what Tosafot says over here. Shemi Kadmenu Acher Birachamim. Maybe someone else will daven, and through davening, undermine what was that preordained shidduch that was coming to you. So Tosafot is trying to deal with two things. If everything's predetermined or preordained, then why do we have any say or ishtadlut in the matter? And it's very troubling or difficult to understand how, if it's all predetermined, what are we doing or what type of free choice do we have? That's number one. And number two is, how do we reconcile this with the Gemara of Shemi Kadmenu Acher? The way that Tosafot solves the problem is to say that tefillah can overturn it. The davening is this element that can undermine this predetermination. So suppose that we have free choice is because you can daven hard enough and that will change the outcome of the situation. That tells what seems to hint at it here and other places says it more explicitly, that it's not enough just davening. It means you've got to daven really hard, and it takes an extreme type of connection through that davening in order to make such a change. So some do read the conclusion of the Gemara here like what you just suggested, that Zivug Rishon and Zivug Sheni has nothing to do with the first marriage or the second marriage. It has to do with Zivug Rishon means if you end up with the shidduch that Hashem had ordained for you, that's Zivug Rishon. Whereas if you go ahead and through your merits and through your own hishtadlut and all work like that, you end up with a different shidduch, that is Zivug Sheni. So that it's not about first marriage, second marriage, it's about there's a preordained shidduch, and then there's also a shidduch based on your personal merits or your personal efforts that you engaged. And so therefore that might be the competing types of Zivugim over here. It's not about two separate Zivugim, but the person is going to either end up in the track of Zivug of preordained or the Zivug of the path of merit or tefillah. This idea that you daven before the conception of the child, that is connected to Kol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Mirat Shemayim, which is that the characteristics, the strengths of the individual are all predetermined. And that's what it means in Kol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Mirat Shemayim, which is that the person's personality, character traits, his propensity to do certain things are all determined ahead of time. So what the nature of the person is, that is predetermined. What you do with those gifts, or what you do with that which is granted to you, that is determined by the individual. That's what it means. Kol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Mirat Shemayim. Mirat Shemayim is what you do with what you are given. So God determines what you're given, but he doesn't determine what you do with what you're given. Now, those traits, or those decisions about what the child is, like for instance, the gender over here, what about the shidduchim, anything you want to daven about a child, the idea that's being presented over here is that that needs to be done before the conception of the child, and there are Tamidei Rabbi Yona and the Gemara and Brachot actually explain a Gemara there that speak about the direction in which a bed is positioned. So everybody gives all these different explanations. The Tamidei Rabbeinu Yonah over there explain that the direction of the bed is a reminder or a hint to this idea that one must beseech Hashem prior to the conception of the child. So the direction of the bed is almost a reminder or a hint to the fact that you need to think about certain things beforehand. Because when you think about them afterwards, it doesn't help. And so that's the idea that you daven beforehand for the child that will be conceived, so that they will have those strengths and those character traits and those things that will be beneficial, that all happens prior to the conception of the child. Matni lo Rav Yehuda le Rav Yitzchak Brei. So Rav Yehuda was teaching his son Rav Yitzchak, Ein adam motzei korat ruach al mishtar rishon. Person only finds a certain amount of satisfaction from his first wife. Shenemar, Yehi mekorcha baruch, usmach me'eshet ne'urecha. Because your source or your fountain should be blessed, and you should rejoice in the wife of your youth. Amar lo kegon man. Why don't you give me an example of what you're thinking of, Dad? Amar lo kegon imcha. He says, like your mother. He says, Hini? Is that really true? Va'mikrei le Rav Yehuda Rav Yitzchak Brei. In another incident where Rav Yehuda was teaching his son Rav Yitzchak, they got to the posuk in Kohelet. Umotziani marmi mavet etayisha shehi mitzodim v'charamim. Says, I find the woman more bitter than death, because she is full of snares and traps. Va'amalo kagon man. So his son says, Dad, why don't you tell me who you're thinking of? Va'amalo kagon imcha, like your mother. So Rav Yehuda here teaching his son Rav Yitzchak in two situations. One situation where he says, oh, there's nobody who brings satisfaction like the woman who you married in your youth. And he says, who's that? He goes, it's your mother. And then he says, well, I find the woman more bitter than death. And he says, who's that? That's your mother. So how do you reconcile between those two statements of Rav Yehuda to his son, Rav Yitzchak? So the answer is, mitkaf tkifa, ivure ma'abro b'milo. So the way Rashi reads it is that she was a tough cookie, but she was placated easily, or she let things go easily. So she would get angry, she would be very strong about things, but Rashi says here, ma'averet amidoteha, that she didn't hold a grudge, and that she let things slide even though they upset her or she got angry about them. So that's the mix here between the two of them. She's a very strong woman. She gets angry easily, and so that's a difficult side of her. On the other hand, she has a midah tova, which is that even though she gets angry and she gets disappointed, she's still easily placated, or she's able to handle that disappointment or not hold grudges about that disappointment. Amarav Shmuel bar Onia Medrav, Isha Golem hi, the woman is unformed matter. And she only is bound to the one who makes her into a utensil. Shenemar, ki vo'alayich osayich Hashem tzvakot shemo. The one who is your bow is the one who makes you. So that's the connection here. The osayich is connected to bo'alayich or to the word bow. So now, this is something that the Maral, if you look in the Maral's writings, he takes up a lot, which is the idea that a woman is a golem, or unformed matter, and that the male, or the zachar, is the tzura that is given to that unformed matter. And in many agadotot, and in many situations where the Maral is trying to explain something, he uses this idea of the male and the female, and the idea of golem versus tzura, as the structure between, or the balance between the male and the female. And how the zachar brings the embedded, unbridled potential within the female to fruition or to practical use. Tana, enish meit, ela lishto, enisha meit, ela lebala. That a man only dies to his wife, and a woman only dies to her husband. So there is this unique relationship between a husband and wife, where the impact of the death of the other is tremendous. And as opposed to others who also feel the loss, but here the Gemara says that there's a unique relationship between a husband and wife, that when they lose each other, that it's a very, very painful and powerful loss for that individual. And that's what it means here, that the husband doesn't die except for his wife. And of course he dies, he affects his children, he affects other people there too. But for the wife, there's a particular pain associated with losing her partner in life, and the same is true in the other direction as well. And we have an example of that. Because it says over there, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, passed away. So who was the one who was affected, or who's the one that is delineated over here as being impacted most profoundly by the death? That's Naomi, who was affected by her husband's death, Elimelech. So again, Yaakov describes it that Rachel died for him, but she didn't die for everybody else. No, but there's a particular pain and anguish that comes from the death of a spouse. And so that unique relationship that exists between a husband and wife is similar to the unique relationship between Bnei Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And just like that is represented by the Mikdash, so too the relationship between a husband and wife is represented by that marriage. And therefore here the Gemara speaks about many of those parallels between them. And just like there is no consolation or recovery from the Korban HaBayit or the Avilut of the Korban HaBayit, so too there's this profound and unique Avilut associated with the breaking of that marriage, as well as the only satisfaction that the individual finds or pleasure that one gets is from that marriage, similar to Bnei Yisrael's relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, Einro Ninoto says here with regards to the king, they're not allowed to see him getting his haircut. Talking about him, Melech Mistaper B'chol Yom. The king gets a haircut every day. Kohen Gadol, Erev Shabbat, to Erev Shabbat. Kohen Gadol gets it weekly. Kohen Ejot, Echad B'Shloshim Yom. The Kohen Ejot gets it every 30 days. Melech Mistaper B'chol Yom. The reason the king gets a haircut every day is, Shenemar, Melech B'yofyo Techazena Einecha. There's a certain amount of beauty and handsomeness you would expect to see in the king. And therefore there's a pasuk that says that a king in his beauty, your eyes should be cast upon. So there's a proper that the people that see the king should see him in the best light and should see him in a certain stature of the position that he holds should also be reflected in his physical appearance. And so therefore it's important that he always looks good for his constituents. Kohen Gadol Me'erev Shabbat Erev Shabbat. Why does the Kohen Gadol get cut weekly? Amarav Shmuel Bar Nachman Amar Yochan Oyo Mishmarot Mitchachot. Since every week the new Mishmar comes in, it's appropriate that the Kohen Gadol looks his best when the new Mishmar comes in. Kohen Yod Techad Shloshim Yom. Kohen Yod gets cut every 30 days. Dechtev, because the Pasuk says in Yechezkel, V'rosham Lo Yigalechu, Upera Lo Yishalechu. So their heads you may not shave, but they also may not grow out their hair wildly. Kasom Yechismu Et Roshehem. They should mow their heads. In essence, they should get a haircut on a regular basis. Pera Minazir. And when you have a Gzerah Shavah, the Pera there from Yechezkel to the Pera that's found by Nazir, Tivach Pera Lo Yishalechu, that's what it says in Yechezkel about the Kohanim. Uchtiv Atam, and by the Nazir it says, Gadel Pera Se'arosho, that he will grow his hair out wildly. Malalan Shloshim, just like by the Nazir, the minimum amount, and Stam Nizirut is 30 days. Afkan Shloshim, so too over here, the minimum amount that we consider to be a pera for the Kohen would be 30 days. Tanan Nami, Stam Nizirut Shloshim Yom. And we know, the Mishnah says that a regular Nizirut or your standard default Nizirut is 30 days. And how do you know that a Nazir's standard or default is 30 days? It says that he will be Kadosh. Is 30, Yud-Hey, and Yud-Hey is 15, and 15 is 30. So based on that, we have a connection between the Nazir and the Kohen. And just like by the Nazir, we demand that he grow out his hair a minimum of 30 days. That's what the Paraloi Shalechu, that's what the Kohen is not allowed to grow, is the same way that the Nazir grows. Since the Nazir is demanded to grow 30 days, it implies that the Kohen may not grow his hair beyond the 30 days, because that would be considered a para. Amalei Rav Papa the Abaye. So Rav Papa, the student of Abaye, says to him, Ema lo lirbu klau. Maybe they shouldn't be able to grow their hair at all, because he thinks that this restriction against growing out their hair is something that is complete and unequivocal, that nothing should grow at all. Amalei Iktev lo yishalechu pera kidamart. If the pasuk says they shouldn't grow out a pera, then I would have said what you said. Since it says para first, it's telling you that you're allowed to have a para, but shaluche lo yishalchu, but you can't grow it out. So now, you're allowed a para, but not allowed to grow it out. Which the Rashi over here explains, and it's a difficult explanation, because that's not the way that we view para in other places in the Torah, but here Rashi says, lo yishalchu klal means a feel like shloshim, should be able to grow it even to 30 days. You're allowed to grow your hair out 30 days. But you can't let it go beyond that. Whereas the Bali Tosfot say over here, let us say that he shouldn't grow it out at all. Then what are you going to do with para para if you say that he wasn't going to grow it at all? They shouldn't grow out 30 days. Not the difference between the two opinions is one day. So doesn't mean don't grow it out at all. It means don't grow it 30 days. It means you're permitted to grow it 29 days and not 30 days. The way we have the pasuk is, You're allowed to grow it 30 days, a pera, but you can't lo yishalechu. You can't grow it beyond that 30-day period. Right now, the Gemara says, if that's the case, eid nanami, then why today do Kohanim not cut their hair on a regular basis? Dumya the yayin, similar to what we do by wine. So the answer to the Gemara is, no. The cutting of the hair is similar to the drinking of wine. My yayin bizman biyahu dasur, shalom bizman biyashari. Just like by yayin, by wine, the only time you're restricted from drinking wine is when you enter into the mikdash. A kohen can drink wine whenever he wants, as long as he's not going to the mikdash. So that is bizman biyahu dasur, shalom bizman biyashari. But you're not planning on going into the mikdash or serving the mikdash, then it's permitted to drink wine. Apure rosh, the same thing with growing one's hair out. Zman biya asur. If you are going to do service in the mikdash, then it would be problematic. Shalom zman biya shari. If it's a time that you're not going to the mikdash, you can grow out your hair as much as you want. Today, it would be never, because he never has anything to do in terms of service, so therefore you shouldn't have to cut his hair at all today. So he says, v'yayin shalom zman biya shari. Is wine really permitted even when you're not going to the mikdash? Vatanya. Rabbi Omer, Omer Ani, so Rabbi says, I say, Kohanim asurim lishto yayim leolam. Kohanim should never be able to drink wine. Avama says, takanatan kilkilatan. That which helped them actually ruined it for them or undermined them. What Rabbi is responding to is the position of the Chachamim beforehand, who basically say that exactly this, that the Kohanim can't drink wine, because Shema Yibane Beit HaMikdash, maybe the Beit HaMikdash will come into service, and they'll need to be ready to go in and work right away in the Mikdash. So Kohanim, who are familiar with their Mishmar, will only be restricted on the week that they would be serving, or possibly be serving the Mikdash if it was rebuilt. But those Kohanim who don't know which Mishmar they're from, and therefore should be held captive to the necessity not to drink wine, because they might have to come into service in the Mikdash. So Rabbi responds to that, Shetakanatan Kilkalatan. The Churban HaBayit changed that dynamic, which is that the Churban HaBayit made it, first of all, that they lost that which Mishmar they belonged to, so they actually didn't know when they needed to deal with it, as well as the fact that we don't worry about the Beit HaMikdash being built in a hurry. That's what Rashi says, Pidom. Suddenly appearing out of nowhere, we don't worry about that. And therefore, Rabbi says that the Churban HaBayit led to a position where Kohanim now can drink without worrying about it. Zavamar HaBayit Keman Shati Kanei Chamra Yidna. Kohanim today, how do they drink wine, or according to whom do they drink wine? Kirabi, like the position of Rabbi you said over here. Mechladur Abonon Asrei. Here it sounds like the Rabbanan say you cannot drink wine. Kohanim today could not drink wine. So then, why can they cut the hair according to the sheet of the Rabbanan? Why should it be different than wine? Shema Yibane Beit HaMikdash. Maybe the Beit HaMikdash will be built and their hair won't be cut. Hatamainu Taima. No, the reason over there is Meir Yibane Beit HaMikdash, that the Mikdash may be built suddenly. And we're going to need a coin is ready to go into the avodah. Veleka. And there's nobody around because they're all drinking. They're all drunk. Why don't you say the same thing by hair? We're going to need a coin is ready to go in. And if his hair is all grown out, he's not going to be ready to get to work. Over here, he can cut his hair and then go in. What's the big deal? You get a haircut and then you go to work. But there you have the same thing. He can rest a little bit, he can nap a little bit, and let it wear off. Damravacha, derech, mio, vishena, koshu, mefiginatayayin. Person walks a little bit, goes a meal, or a little bit of sleep, mefiginatayayin. They remove the intoxication that one is feeling. So you can deal with intoxication by removing it quickly, just like you deal with the long hair by getting a haircut immediately. So why should there be any difference between them? Wait, didn't we qualify that and say, that's only if he consumed the revi'it worth of wine. But yoter mikdei revi'it, if he consumed a little more than revi'it, and certainly if he starts to walk distances, or he goes to sleep, then that's going to put him deeper into his stupor. And so that's why the Rabbonim would differentiate between cutting hair, which can be rectified immediately and quickly, versus intoxication, which would take time to relieve, and therefore, they can't be drinking because of that possibility of Meher Yibane Beit HaMikdash. The Shtui Yayin, that if they do Avoda, despite the fact that they're drunk, or Avoda they do in the Mikdash is profaned and is meaningless. Ruei Rosh, Delo Machle Avoda, on the other hand, someone whose hair is grown out, does not profane or affect the avoda that's done. So therefore, lo gazru b'hu rabbonon. And that explains the difference over here between yayin and hair. So even though we might have considered the issue of Shema Yibaneh Beit HaMikdash. There is a difference between Yayin and hair. So, Meitavei. The Elu Shebimita. These are people who are subject to a death penalty for violating the laws. Prue Rosh. Someone whose hair is grown out. Shtui Yayin, and someone who drank wine. Bishlama Shtui Yayin Edichtiv. By Shtuyin, we know it. Yayin Vishikhar Altesht. Atalvanecha Velotamutu. Because it says specifically or directly to our own that you and your children should not drink wine or intoxicating beverages so that you do not die. Ela Prue Rosh Minolon. How do we know that that's the same is true by Prue Rosh? Div Kishtu Yayin the Prue Rosh. Because there is a hekesh between these two items. Div Rosham Lo Yigalechu Upera Lo Yishalechu. That's the pasuk we quote from Yecheskel before. Uchtiv Batrei. It says right after that, V'yayin Lo Yishtu. They may not drink wine. Maishtu Yayin Bimita. Apure Rosh Bimita. Just like someone who drinks and then goes into the Mikdash is subject to a death penalty. So too, someone whose hair is not cut and goes into the Mikdash is also subject to a death penalty. So Gemara says, Umina. From there you learn also, Mashtuye Yayin de Machle Avoda, Apure Rosh de Machle Avoda. Just like the Shtuye Yayin, those that drink wine, profane the Avoda, so too the Pure Rosh should be profaning the Avoda. Akasha, that is a problem. How to deal with the Hekesh or partial Hekesh. Amalei Ravina Ravashi, Hayad de Loata Yechezkel Manamra. It's very strange. We're learning out this Hekesh from Yechezkel. We're learning out all these halakhot of the Kohanim from Yechezkel. What happened to the fact that it's all supposed to be in the Torah and not in the time of the Navi? It's Gemara says, L'tamech, Adam Rav Chista, Dover Zeh, Mitorat Moshe Rabbeinu Lo Lamadnu, Ad Sheba Yechezkel Vimadnu. So, Yechezkel came along and taught us these dinim. Ko Ben Nechar, Ero Leiv, Ve'ero Basar Lo Yavo Mikdashi. So the Pasuk says in Yechezkel, someone who has an uncircumcised heart, or is uncircumcised, should not enter into the Mikdash. That is because one of them is Nitnakru Masal Avisha B'Shamayim, the person who's left the faith, therefore he's disqualified from working in the Mikdash or serving Hashem. Erol Basar is someone whose brothers died from Brit Milah, therefore he did not get a Brit Milah. Both of them are precluded from serving in the Mikdash. Ad Lobaya Hezkel Man Amra, till Hezkel came along, who put these together? So the question is, that you find in the Pasuk in Yechezkel, where do you find that in the Torah? So it sounds like Yechezkel brought in a new law over here. Gemara says, no, Ela Gemara Gemira law. It's a halacha l'Moshe Misinai, it's a Mesorah from Moshe Rabbeinu Misinai. V'ad Yechezkel v'asmecha akra. Yechezkel, all he did was write it down in a Pasuk that incorporated that which was the halacha l'Moshe Misinai. Achanami, so to in our case, Gemara Gemira law. V'ad Yechezkel v'asmecha akra. They had the word already from Moshe Rabbeinu through the halacha l'Moshe Misinai. Yechezkel just wrote it down into a pasuk in order to document it as to what the halacha of the Moshe of Sinai was. But that shows that there was no change in the halacha or nothing ever changed over here. And therefore, that really deals with the issue of Ein Hekesh the Mechza. The Gemara's real question was, how can you compare Shtuye Yayin to cutting the hair only partially, where the death penalty will be put up to both of them, but they both won't have the effect of being Machle Avoda of profaning the service in the Mikdash. And the answer is, it's Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. And that's why you can have that differentiation. And that's what the Baal Tosfot point out, that that's how you can reconcile Rav Ashi's position over here. That's why there is this distinction between the profaning of the Avoda by drinking versus cutting one's hair. It will also help us earlier on to explain why we are able to make that Gzer Shava Pera Pera to Yechezkel. Then that Gzer Shava from Nazir is considered to be on par or in level with the halacha that we're learning by Kohanim. And we're not learning from Divrei Torah, the Divrei Kabbalah. And that's what the halacha L'Moshe Misinai helps us to know where to apply or not apply those halachot. Or you can answer that it's a Giloi Milta. That which we learn from Nazir just tells us the definition of the word Pera. So, my kasom yechismu et roshehem. What does it mean that they will mow their heads? Tana kemin tisporet lulainit. It's like this lulainit haircut. Mighty sport lulainit. What is this lulainit type of haircut? Reviewed on Mashmuel, tisporta yechida. Is this beautiful and unmatched type of haircut? So, hey, chidami, what exactly is this haircut? Aravashi, roshoshal zeh, betzadikaroshal zeh. That the tip of each hair touches the root of the hair next to it. And as Tosfot explains, that relates to the wording in Yechezkel, which is kasum yechsimu, perirosh kein kusemet. Hagadel kach, that's similar to the way that the spelt grows, which is Shibolim Rosh Shoshel Zeh B'tzadik Rosh Shoshel Zeh. That when it comes to the stalks of the spelt, the head of one is near the base of the next. Shalom Adrabi, Izut Dispersal Kohen Gadol. What is the haircut of the Kohen Gadol involved? Malen Tzuru'u Mitispersal Ben Elasha. Go and ask Ben Elasha what it looks like, or go see what Ben Elasha looks like, because then you'll know. Ben Elasha was Rabbi's son-in-law, who was extremely wealthy. And even though the Pasuk of Kasom Yichsamu is written by all Kohanim, not the Kohen Gadol, it seems that this type of haircut was so unique that they would have only associated it with the Kohen Gadol. Or maybe Latid Lavo, it would apply to all Kohanim, and that's what's being said in Yechezkel. Tanya, Rabbi Omer, O'achinam Pizer Ben Elasha et Me'otav. It wasn't for naught that Ben Elasha spent all that money. Elikadela wrote both his spiritual Kohen Gadol in order to demonstrate or figure out what the haircut of the Kohen Gadol looked like. Now Rashi says over here, he did it in order to learn the trade or that type of haircutting in order that he could do it himself. Although from the Gemara, that does not sound like what he was doing. Rather, it sounds like he got that haircut in order that people will see or be able to demonstrate to others what the tzporet of the Kohen Gadol was. Okay, with that we finish the second perek. Hadron Halach, Kohen Gadol.